So this week, we're going to talk about secrets to successful interviews for your travel articles. In particular, I want to cover sort of four hows, but I'm going to cover them in a little bit of a roundabout way. So you're not going to see title slides later in the webinar where I'm saying, no, we're going to talk about how to prepare. I'm going to kind of go through cohesively, and in keeping with the topic, I've actually sort of created some quotes of my own. As people say, tweetables. I'm not saying go tweet this webinar, but I've created some quotes of my own that are kind of one-liners, and I've also pulled from various articles about how journalists should do interviews quotes. So the slides are going to be a little bit different this week. We're going to be using slides that are more quote-oriented as we go along. But the four hows that I want to cover are how to prepare for your interview. And part of that, but it's a bit separate, is how to formulate the right questions. And then in the interview, how to maintain the rapport so that you get the best possible quotes. And then my favorite question that'll give you 95% of the time, the money quote, as journalists say. I, for years, especially when I was working for trade magazines, did between 20 and 60 interviews a month. And it sounds like a lot, but the thing is that I've never been a newsroom journalist, and I think that your average sort of full-time staff journalist probably does a lot more. They're probably doing like 6 or 8 interviews minimum a day, a work day. So the thing is that once you start writing more articles, and especially writing articles in our first person, but even when you are writing first person articles, you're going to find that interviews are not just a necessary evil, but are something that's necessary really to getting the best possible piece. And they're a little bit addictive. Once you start doing them, you'll really quickly see that they make your life much, much easier. In the newsletter and the webinar preceding this call, or sorry, in the newsletter and the blog post preceding this call, I talked about how a lot of freelance writers that I talk to, a lot of freelance travel writers, are really struggling with time, with having enough time to pitch, with getting their articles done in enough time for it to be worth the rate for them, with feeling like it takes them too long to do the work they have now, so they couldn't possibly do better or more challenging or longer pieces. And one of the things that I've really found doing interviews, and especially doing a lot of them in general, and also for a particular story, is that interviews really help you write the article. In fact, they can help almost write it for you and really cut down on that research time. And we're going to talk a bit about that as well. So I just want to mention a couple questions that have come in. Someone had a question about recording the interview. We're going to talk about that. And do you need to have an article idea already pitched to do an interview? This is an interesting one. So I'm talking right now kind of in general about interviews, but in the direction of interviews that you're doing for a specific piece. And another way you can do interviews is to do interviews for your pitches. You can do interviews to get background information for your pitch. And this is actually a really great trick for all of you guys that want to write about things that you don't already have clips in, like an area that you don't know very well. For those of you in the Pitchapalooza right now, these are like our focus areas that we're talking about. If there's one that you want to research but you don't know it very well, doing some interviews, some brief ones, just some background interviews before your pitch so that you have become more of an expert can be a really great way to get that story. And if you want to be doing an interview for your pitch, the way to make sure that you're on the up and up with the source is to tell them very clearly that you're doing background to put together a story idea, not to put together a story. And if they say, what does that mean? Then you can come out and say, it hasn't been assigned. I'm talking to you to get information to help present it to the editor so they can consider assigning it to me. So that's the way to go about that. Another couple questions. I know it can be easier to pitch a piece if you've already completed an interview, but it feels strange to ask someone to take the time to do an interview if I'm not sure I'll ever find a place to publish it. So this is related to the other question, but a little bit different. And so when I was talking about how you can do interviews for your pitch that are really just background and quick, what I mean there is they're not the same as what you would do for your piece. So we're going to talk about what you need to get from the interview, from each interview, and what you need to get in terms of the amount and the type of information to put together a pitch is different than the amount and type of information that you need to put together an article. So in this case, if you want to interview somebody for the pitch, it's going to be much shorter, you're going to ask them fewer questions, and you'll say, if we proceed with the piece, can I speak to you again more at length? That's how you would handle that. So before I start talking about the four hows, I want to ask you guys, how many of you are intimidated by the idea of doing interviews for an article? Just from the questions that I've seen come through, it sounds like a lot of you are, but just kind of like a quick show of hands, you can just say yes, or you can say a little bit more at length. But I really find this is a big kind of gray area. And when I say gray, I don't mean morally gray or ethically gray. I mean, it's just kind of foggy. Like when you start, especially when you start travel writing, more so than other types of freelance writing, you might hear if you want to be a travel writer, you need to talk to people or you can't be shy and things like that. You know, somebody just said, especially in another language, and she's doing some work in a Spanish-speaking country right now, and I have a friend who also does a lot of work in Spanish-speaking countries, and she's been doing it for, you know, God, like 20 years now, and she still feels like her business Spanish, as she calls it, isn't there, even though she's been doing it for such a long time. And we had one great response here. I love to interview. I can get people to talk. That's great. And I think one of the things is that interviewing is, in a way, just talking. But the problem is, it's talking with strangers, right? So I think that's one of the things that makes it awkward, right? Is that you're talking with somebody who you have asked to do something for you. It's not even just someone you're sitting next to on an airplane or, you know, somebody's friend that you're all out together and you're just striking up chit-chat because you're sitting next to each other at the bowling alley or whatever. It's somebody who you not only don't know, but you feel beholden to, or you feel like you kind of have to, you know, make the best of it and make them feel special because they've done this thing for you at your request. And there's a little bit of uncertainty if you can deliver on the expectations that they have in terms of doing that interview with you, right? So I want to talk to you just for a very quick second about the very first interview that I remember doing, at least. Maybe I did another one sort of anecdotally before this that I don't recall. So I'm going to show you the output from the interview in a second. But before I left my job to freelance the second time, if you know my whole backstory, but before I left my job to freelance the second time, I had started a blog. It was a food blog, and it was kind of food, entertaining, travel, if you really want to be specific. And I had been working on it, you know, it was going well, people liked it, and then I moved to California because part of the reason that I left my job when I did was because my husband, who wasn't my husband at the time, lived on the other side of the country, and I kind of had to move there in order for us to get married. And so I said, okay, great, now I'm going to make my blog my full-time thing. So when I first left my job, I kind of intended to make my blog a thing. And very shortly after arriving in California, I somehow, through some blogger group or something, got invited to an event that Epicurious was doing. If you don't know Epicurious, it's related to Bon Appetit. It's a big recipe website. To an event that they were doing in San Francisco at the Ferry Building that was part of Michelle Obama's Let's Move campaign. And part of it was that you had the opportunity to interview the editor-in-chief of Epicurious. Anybody who knows food or enjoys food or likes to cook at home knows that Epicurious is kind of a big deal, so she's obviously kind of a big deal. And I was very flustered by this opportunity because I frankly had no idea what to ask her, how to ask her things, kind of how to do it. And of course, being a writer herself, she was very chill about it, but I spent all of this time, I remember even on the train going up to San Francisco that day, I was reviewing articles about how to put together your interview questions and all these things. And now, looking at the interview that I published, I'll flip over to that now, I feel like I didn't do a horrible job. And this might happen to you, your first interview, or you might look back at it and be like, wow, I should have asked much better questions. And I'll tell you some things that are wrong with these questions. We'll look at this later in the webinar as well. But I think one of the things is that, as we're going to talk about, it's about having a conversation. And if either of the people is uncomfortable and the other party makes them more comfortable, you'll end up having a good conversation. So even if you are intimidated about doing interviews, if you start by interviewing like willing subjects per se, or people who are very accustomed to doing interviews, you'll probably have an easier time starting out. Like if anybody is really scared about doing interviews and has a blog where it makes sense and you wanted to interview me, I could totally do that with you and we could make sure that you had good questions and things like that. But it really helps in the beginning, when you're sort of afraid of it, to not set yourself up with a difficult interviewee. I've worked with a lot of those over time, and it can be really like pulling teeth sometimes. So if you do have any sort of hesitation, don't put yourself in that situation from the get-go. But for instance here, and I don't know, because it's been quite a few years, I don't know that these were the original questions that I wrote down verbatim, or if these were kind of how I tailored them to go on the website later. But these questions are not just a bit long, like the first one and the last one are a bit long. Long length is not so much a problem, but a lot of the questions are really leading. So if any of you have, you know, really like legal television shows, or, you know, did mock trial when you were young or something like that, you'll know a leading question is where the within the body of the question, it's set up so it's kind of meant for the question to either verify itself, like blah, 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 isn't that right? Or that the question is designed with an answer in mind that you're pointing the respondent to. So in this case, like, I say, I know that since you came on as Chief at Epicurious, there's been more, sorry, I can't read because I've got this thing in the way. There's been more focus on entertaining content. What are some of your favorite easy appetizers? So the thing is, like, the setup there is background. And I could easily have taken this the wrong way. I could have easily said there's been more focus on entertaining content. I know you've been putting up a lot of, you know, crostini or something like that. But then I came back, I saved it, and I kept it open. I just said, what are your favorite easy appetizers with farm produce, okay? Now, up here, for instance, in the first one, though, it's a little leading, right? So I say, from your own experience and observation, so I'm asking for her to give an anecdote, but I say, has the growing farmers market culture caused people to take more interest in cooking at home? So I'm kind of expecting her to say yes, right? I'm kind of leading her to say yes and expand on this topic. And that's not the end of the world, but you're not going to get your best answers. You're going to get your best answers when you ask something that's very open. So for instance, the third question here, it's a little like, I don't know that this person should be saying these things, right? Like, I don't know that she, as the editor of Epicurious, should be telling people whether they should have a farm share or a CSA. Like, I don't think she's allowed to, you know? So by saying, is a CSA a better option than farm fresh produce when she's on a tour about farmers market, it's a little odd of a question, right? So you want to make the interviewee and yourself as comfortable as possible. And let's look at some different ways to do this. So first of all, at its core, like at the most basic components, I didn't quote this because I couldn't remember where I found it, because I did quite a bit of reading to find some good quotes for today. But at its core, an interview is a question and listening to the answer. And I'll add to that, I think part of what makes it an interview is recording or noting in some way the answer. And we'll get to more about recording in a second. But I just want you all to know that no matter how sort of simple I say this process is, that you're just talking to somebody, this is really not, it's not so much that it's something that cannot be taught, but in a little bit, it's the thing that everybody finds out for themselves. And in a way, it's because everyone's going to have a slightly different interview technique. I have a friend who is also a travel writer, but she as well as a general interest journalist for the Finnish press, some of you might know her, and she's been doing a lot of coverage of the US political situation. And that has had her going to both the Republican and Democratic national conventions, talking to people who are, you know, heavily armed at the Republican convention, or people who are highly outraged at a protest. And when you're in those sort of situations, having training of some type, you know, making sure that you don't offend and incense and in any way sort of hinder the relationship with the subject is important. And she has a master's in journalism, right? But the thing is that a lot of the interviews that you might be doing, it's not the end of the world. It's not make or break if you are going to be asking somebody a personal question. There's very few situations I find as travel writers, and this is going to be like a horribly misquoted Don George right here, but there's few situations we find ourselves in as travel writers where a really genuine smile and an apology can't get us back from where we are. And I'm not saying dangerous situations, but I mean in terms of trying to connect with people. So most people have not had training in how specifically to conduct interviews, even in journalism school. So don't feel like you are behind the quote-unquote real journalists of the world. And when I say people haven't had real training, often in masters of journalism, they're sending people out to do interviews, but it's not so much that you're sitting there breaking down, okay, and you ask this question then, and if somebody says this, then you volley and parry and say this instead. But we're actually going to do that in the next couple weeks. So as we are talking about interviews, I just want to point out what are the three component parts of what's difficult about an interview, because there's some things that you might have questions about that we're going to talk about in other weeks. And so the first step is getting someone to talk to you, right? And I think that was a lot of the questions that people had before, which is, can you ask somebody for an interview if you haven't been assigned a piece? You know, how does that work? What if it never gets published? So next week we're going to talk about how to get someone to talk to you in the first place, and how specifically to make sure you find the right people. Because this is a big thing. I often see people choose, how should I say it? It's not so much that they're lesser on the totem pole, but they're individuals who might have access to information, whether because they work for an organization or because they're at an event or something like that. But they're not the ones that are going to give you the most opportune quotes. And part of that might be, as I mentioned before, if you're feeling a little nervous about doing interviews, part of that might be that these people aren't experienced doing interviews, but I've had really, really great interviews with people who've never done an interview in their life. So part of it is just personality, and part of it is passion. And we'll talk more about that next week. So the second roadblock of making an interview a success is getting information that's actually useful. And that's what we're going to talk about today. And then the hard part, in theory, but this I think is actually the easy part, is what to do with that useful information once you do get it. And so we're going to do a couple live demo webinars at the end of the month, or the last two webinars this month. And so one of them, the one 2 weeks from now, I'm going to take interviews from articles that I've done before. So actual live interviews that I did where I transcribed them. I transcribe during the call because I type very fast. So I'm going to take my transcripts of the interviews, and we're going to go through them and piece them out into where they belong in the article, and then we're going to clean them up and put them together in the article. So any sort of questions you have about cleaning up quotes and things like that, we'll talk about then. And then the week after that, I'm going to have a couple guests on the webinar. Hopefully there will be no technical difficulties for that. And I will interview them live. So I will pick people who have either destinations or businesses, and I will brief you all with like a made-up article idea that I'm going to interview them about, and then we'll talk, and you can listen to how I get information from them, how I get them to change topics, you know, how I phrase my questions, how I ask them to expand on things, stuff like that. So that's what we're going to be talking in other weeks. So if you have questions about those topics, save them for the other times. So I want to go back to, I'll just go back to the slide, what I was talking about here. How do we get information from our interviews that's actually useful? Because that's really, in terms of the content of the interview, the doing of the interview, that's the most important thing, is to make sure that you're not just sitting on the phone for 5, 10, 15, 25, 30 minutes having a chat, and everything that has been said has no business in your article whatsoever, either because the person just was going off about something else and you couldn't rein them in, or because you didn't have a good sense of what the article was about or how the quotes need to be used in your article. There's a lot of different reasons that you can go through a whole interview and leave with some nothing of use. So, first of all, why should you be using interviews for your stories? Not just in your stories, but for your stories, because I'm going to talk also about how you don't necessarily need to use quotes if you're interviewing people to enrich your pieces. So, were any of you, I don't think so, looking at who's on the call, but were any of you at TVEX in Greece like 3 years ago, the one in Athens, by any chance? I don't think so, but just in case I didn't know you then and you were maybe there. So Robert Reed, who was a big editor, I don't know that he was editor-in-chief per se, but he was high up and he was the talking head on all the news outlets for Lonely Planet a few years back. Robert Reed did the keynote, the closing keynote at the Athens TVEX, and he had a wonderful set of slides that I've asked him for a bunch of times and he doesn't have them, so sadly I can't share them with you. But in these slides, he took a New York Times article and a blog post that were about the same destination, same kind of angle, and he put them next to each other and color-coded them. So he showed how much and what placement of the articles were first-person narrative, background, like historical background, quotations, descriptions of places, facts and figures. He had colors for all these different things. And you can probably imagine kind of what is the punchline there, but it was really interesting and I think important to look at these two things side by side and really see in something like a travel article in the New York Times how much of it is quotes or is historical background and not the first person experience. So when I write a lot of pieces that I'm writing, particularly ones that aren't first-person narrative, but a lot of things that I write, most of what I'm saying is one of these things, right? It's facts, it's historical background, maybe it's a quote. And how often do you find yourself writing something that's, you know, some kind of place description, some kind of attraction description, a roundup, what have you, where the things that you are writing in the 200 words or whatever you have to describe this thing are description of a sort, but you're not necessarily including, you know, statistics, and if you've gotten those statistics, where have you gotten them from? Or are you able to get a statistic that isn't online? Are you able to go dig around in some white papers? These are the types of things that, you know, are often described as kind of old school journalism. But the thing that I really love about doing interviews is that you cut through the need to spend a lot of time digging around for facts and figures and details and what's new without using the internet, yes, but also faster than you would do on the internet. So I've had times where the exact same type of piece, I couldn't get the interview for some reason. You know, the person wouldn't talk to me, they were on vacation, something fell through, you know, I was having a snit with the person who runs, well, I won't say who, and I just couldn't get the interview. And so then I had to go to that person, place, whatever's website and reviews about them and different things and piece it together that way. And my God, it took me at least 3 or 4 times longer to get the same information, more or less, but it wasn't as good because I didn't have stories, I didn't have anecdotes, I didn't have examples. For instance, you know, I used to do a Broadway guide for a magazine about group travel. And one time I got to write about this really cool thing, I'm blanking on the name, but it was called Broadway Classroom, I think. And they basically have groups, you can do it as a private group, you can just do it with your friends, they do it with school groups, all sorts of groups, that they team up with actual people who are in Broadway shows, and those people teach them the song or they teach them the dance, and then they all do it together and they can like film it, and they have like a little bit of the classes about, you know, stage fighting or projection or something like that. But they're doing it with the people who are actually in Broadway shows. And I had no idea that this stuff was going on. So I could have gone to the website and read that they had those offerings, but they don't list exactly who from what shows, or they don't tell you on the website the specifics of how the schedule works around days when they have both a matinee and an evening show. And they certainly don't give you the anecdotes of the group of teenage girls who were there for a Sweet 16 party and how they oohed and aahed over the star and, you know, he signed whatever for them. You're not going to get those things by researching places online. So you won't get them unless you do interviews. But furthermore, even if you were to maybe somehow be able to get them, you're going to get them much more slowly trying to do that on your own, rather than just going to the most qualified person who knows about this thing. And any of you who have been on fam trips or press trips and gone on tours have probably experienced this. I used to work for some individuals that ran a concierge travel booking business in Italy, and I remember them saying that they thought they knew everything about this town in a not-so-well-known area of Italy, and then they went on a tour and they were blown away because here they have a business about this. But the person who specialized, because in Italy you have to have a master's, if not two masters, to be a tour guide, the person who had devoted their whole life to this obviously knew much, much more than them. So always think about, no matter how well you think you know a topic, who has really devoted themselves to becoming the expert about this, and what can they tell you that's going to make your article or your pitch so much better? So, useful information, right? We've talked about why you need it, but how can you use it? So this circles back to what people were asking before about what if I want to include it in my pitch. There's different types of interviews that you do, and not all of them are meant to have quotations that are concise and brilliant and beautiful, or to give you anecdotes like the 16-year-old girl that I was just telling you. Sometimes you are talking to one person in order to figure out who else you should talk to get those things. So that's when you're doing an interview, to connect you with other resources. And a really good example of this in travel is talking to the Convention and Visitors Bureau, the tourism board. If you aren't talking to or interviewing the CVB of wherever you are going, you are missing out, because quite honestly, there could be things opening that there is no way that you would know about or be able to go to without that connection. Have any of you guys heard of hard hat tours? Is that a term that any of you guys know? So a hard hat tour is when, I do these typically with hotels, but it's when anything isn't open to the public yet, but specifically press and VIPs are able to go in and walk around and take a look around and see the thing being made, like see the hotel rooms literally being put together as they add the furniture and they add the linens and all these things. But these are opportunities that if you talk to the person from the Convention and Visitors Bureau and tell them what you are interested in and ask them what is available, these things can be connected to. And so that's one type of interview that you would definitely do, for instance, when you're in the pitching phase. And that's something that's completely expected, that you don't necessarily have an assignment at that point, that you're gathering information. But there's other types of background or information gathering interviews that you might be doing. And those are often when you don't know so much about a topic. So for instance, let's say you have a lot of background in Italy, but you don't necessarily know so much about wine. And you have just sold all of your possessions and you are going to be nomadic for the next year and you are going to be in Italy for 4 months. And you know, you've been setting up some ideas of researching your genealogy and, you know, food, which is a big thing that you write about, but you're not really a wine buff. Like, you like to drink it, but you don't really know how it's made, you know, different ways that they prune the trees or that they hang them on the line, so to say. You don't know anything about that or why they do it or if it's important or why it would be important. So a background interview might be the type of thing when you're talking to somebody to get them to sort of teach you about a subject. And so in this case, I was saying wine, which is rather broad, but say you know wine, say you know French wine, but you find yourself in, where was I, in North Carolina for a conference, and you're visiting all these wineries in North Carolina, and even though you have been writing about wine for 10 years, you really know nothing about native North American grapes. And in North Carolina, they have this grape that was there when the settlers first came from Europe, and it withstood phylloxera, which was this virus, I believe, or maybe bacteria that decimated all of the European grapes. And so all of the rootstock in America, like all of the Californian grapes, happen to now be an amalgam of this American grape that's in North Carolina and other European stocks. But you don't really know anything about the Carolina grapes besides that, besides how they touch on French wines. So a background interview that you would do there would be perhaps with somebody who owns a winery or perhaps with somebody who works at a university who can tell you all about how that works. And background interviews are especially useful, not just when you don't know about a topic, but when the readers that you want to be communicating this to also don't know about the topic. Because this is the kind of thing, and we'll get to a good question to use in this case later, but this is the kind of thing where you want to have somebody give you quotes, perhaps, or things that you can paraphrase. You might not use a quote as a quote, but you might just rewrite a little bit of it and essentially use it. So they're going to give you quotes that will tell you the step-by-step or the background, and their letters, you know, if they have a PhD or whatever, give them the status where the facts that they are saying can be used with very little fact-checking. So back to what is useful information more generally. Useful, again, depends on your needs. So when I was talking just now about the different types of interviews that you might do for background, for instance, I was talking about a couple different instances of wine, right? So the thing is, how much detail do you need? So if you're this just sold all of your stuff going to Italy person that I just mentioned, and you're doing an article about wine, what is useful information for that? It depends on your audience, depends on your outlet, and depends on the type of story you're writing. And so this goes back to the questions that folks had earlier about doing interviews before your story. If you are just pitching and you don't know exactly what the story is yet, you don't know what type of information you will need for the story. So you don't want to, and it would be disadvantageous to your source as well as yourself, to do a full interview if the end story might be less technical or more technical, to go to this wine aspect, or you might need something broader and you've done an interview that's all about this one winery, but you really need to know more about the region, and so you need to go to the Regional Viticultures Association for that. So useful for your needs, on the one hand, depends on context, it depends on scope, like I've just said, but useful for your needs also depends on the type of information that you need, not just whether it's whether it's useful information, but the actual type. So what this means is, are you writing for an outlet that's more narrative? Do you need to display and describe characters? Are you writing for an outlet that's fun and you really need first-person anecdotes to add some color and some pop and personality to your piece? Or do you really need those technical specific details for the type of place that you are writing for? So I say all this before we talk about the types of questions you should ask and things like this, because it's all related to this, right? The questions that you're going to ask, or what you're going to interrupt, or what you're going to ask for someone to expand on, they're all related to what information you really need for the specific story that you're doing and the specific place in your story that that information has. So now I'm going to get to some of these quotes that I gathered. So this one I like because it goes back to that other one that I mentioned, that an interview is just a question and listening to the response. This is really cutting to the heart of what we're doing here. But I think it's really important because he says, interviewing is the modest, immediate science of gaining trust, then gaining information. Okay, so we've talked about how we feel when we do interviews, right? And we've talked a little about how the source feels, and I said it's easier to do if you have a willing source in the beginning. But the thing that I had mentioned is that you can work with hard sources. You can work with sources that either don't really want to talk to you, aren't really supposed to talk to you, or just aren't good talkers, right? Somebody, I'm trying to go back and figure out who it is. I think Crystal had mentioned that she's great at doing interviews. She can really get people to talk. So there's two things here, right? Is that we need to gain people's trust, we need to get them to talk to us, but then we also need to gain information. And I found that it can be deceptive, especially when you are newer to doing interviews, if somebody is really talkative. Because as I had mentioned, in terms of how you might have a whole interview go by and then realize you don't have anything that can work, if an interviewee is really talkative, you are allowing them to control the narrative, to control the thread of the conversation. And that's not good for your eventual story. So it's really important to keep in mind that everything that we're doing starts with gaining trust. And somebody had said, I think here it is, maybe you'll touch on it later, but when you have a rambler going on and on and on about irrelevant info, how do you get them to stop telling stories and get back on point? This is exactly what I'm talking about here, is that you need to not only gain their trust, because with people who are ramblers, trust is really easily given in terms of letting somebody listen, but you need to gain their trust, not as a listener, but as an interviewer. So part of that, and we're going to talk about how to start and things like that, but part of that is gaining their trust that you are controlling the conversation. And that's a harder thing than just getting somebody to talk to you and then gaining the right information. So let's talk more about the how. So options for setting the scene. I've got a lot of question marks here. So I've kind of grouped these into two categories, chit chat and getting the point. And so what I mean by this division is, do you kind of jump right into it and ask some questions, or do you have preamble is actually what I like to call it. So I have question marks on all of these so that there's no kind of judgment on which one is the right one. So look over these options here and tell me either specifically chit chat or getting to the point, or one of them, or sorry, generally chit chat or getting to the point, or specifically one of these other options, which one you think or you've heard, like what somebody's told you, is the best way to start. Okay, I'm seeing a lot of thanks, compliments, some chit chat. No one's told me to do it, but I usually start with chit-chat along the lines of what they actually do. Yeah, recording to start if new. Uh-huh. I just like to start talking, ask them about themselves. Okay, so I think we've got a most consensus here. So let's talk about each of these in turn. So the thing about chit-chat generally, so the idea of getting on the call and, you know, talking about the weather or asking them, you know, if they saw the debate last night, whatever. And nobody talks about the game anymore, right? We're just talking about politics. So if you're starting with chit-chat, you're doing something very important, which relates to what Alicia said about the ramblers, is that you're establishing that the discourse, this conversation that you're having, is casual. So by me saying that, I'm assuming you can kind of take what my view on that is, but it's really important that I just don't say, oh, you shouldn't chit-chat, but that you should understand why. Because the thing is that when you have someone difficult, you do need to establish that it's casual. So I'm not going to say that there's different ones of these that apply in different situations. I'm going to tell you what I actually think, but there are times when you should do other things on this list than my kind of most recommended varieties. So the thing about chit-chat, like I said, is that it establishes that the conversation is casual. But when you're doing an interview on the phone, I find that it establishes that time is not an issue. And so with ramblers, that can be a problem. But with people who are busy, this can also be a problem, because it's going to make them nervous about their commitment of time to the call as well. So I definitely always think that thanks is a great thing to start with, but it's important not to be obsequious when you're thanking people. So I mentioned how we can feel, especially when we're newer to doing interviews and what the value of interviews is to the interviewee, that we are kind of beholden or on the hook to them because we've asked them to do something for us and we really want to deliver some value to them as well. So if you do start with thanking people, it's important to modulate your tone in doing that and keep it really professional and not that they are doing you a favor. Because it's really important to remember that anytime you are interviewing somebody and it's going to appear in a story, now again, interviewing for pitches, like I said, is a slightly different animal, but anytime you're interviewing for somebody for a story, you are doing them a favor. They didn't ask you, but they feel that. Unless you're talking to, you know, a major politician or a celebrity or somebody you really had to chase down. And in some cases, still you're doing them a favor because they need the coverage. But generally, people are over the moon to be interviewed. Like, it's, I can't even tell you some of the really interesting responses about this that I've gotten. And particularly if you're interviewing them about what they do or if they own the business and you're interviewing them about the business, even beyond the coverage, they are really thankful to have someone interested in it and talk to them about it. So when you do thank people at the beginning and at the end of the call, it's really important to do it in a more equivocal setting rather than being really kind of like, oh my God, thank you so much for taking the time out of your day to do this. I really, really appreciate it. Like, this is really important to my article. That's not how we should be thanking people. So admiration. So what if you have somebody who's a big deal? Do you tell them that you've followed them for some time? Do you tell them, you know, that they were your crush in high school? I don't know that this would come up much in travel unless you're talking to Andrew McCarthy. But do you tell them that? I would say, by and large, it's not super useful, with the exception of when you are talking to somebody who is a subject matter expert as opposed to just has some modicum of celebrity. So somebody who's a subject matter expert and you are familiar with their work, especially to a high degree, this can be really useful for something that we're going to get to later about knowing the background of the piece. So for instance, if you're writing about natural history, I think the person from the Pitchapalooza that specializes that isn't with us, but maybe she is. So if you're writing about natural history in the context of travel, so we had someone in the January Pitchapalooza that wanted to write about the super bloom, which is when Death Valley is covered with flowers. So if you are interviewing someone who is a botanist that specializes in desert flora, and you happen to have a science background and have actually gone and read one of their papers on it, tell them that, because it's going to set a different scene for the interview in terms of their feeling like you get them. And so that's important. But otherwise, just kind of general admiration, I wouldn't do. Now, getting to the point, is it rude? This is a really important consideration, because I really think that it's important to start interviews by getting to the point in some fashion or another, because of what I mentioned before, because it sets up that it's not casual, that this is business, that you're a professional writer and that you're interviewing them and this is your work day. But it can come off as rude in some cultures. This is really the important thing. So in some areas, like I mentioned, if you chit-chat, you'll put the source off because they'll feel like you're wasting their time. In other areas where there's a geographic culture, per se, of chit-chat, then you will completely put the source off if you do not, you know, ask about their weekend or something beforehand. So I think, you know, in balancing these two things, it's also really important always to take into account as much as you're knowledgeable of the etiquette of the place that the person you're talking to resides in, of their culture. So do you want to start by telling them what you're going to ask them? And this is related to, should you send questions in advance? Nobody's asked me that. I'm kind of shocked that no one's asked me, because this is a huge thing that comes up. I think maybe more when you start doing interviews and people ask you to send questions. But sending questions in advance or telling them the questions is this really sticky area. You might hear journalists say, no, you never tell them the questions. They have to be surprised. You have to get their original first-time answers. So I actually always ask for questions when people want to interview me. And the reason that people ask for questions is that they want to know, first of all, what you're asking them about and if it's even worth their time. But second of all, they want to think about some examples to tell you that are relevant to your question, not because they want to prepare talking points per se, but because they want to make sure you have the best information for your interview. The way to do this, though, is to not give people verbatim questions so that they could essentially just fill it in over email and say, okay, the interview's all done, we don't really need to talk now. You want to give them very, very general questions. And this is also what you're going to do when you talk to them, and we'll talk more about the specifics in a second. But if you tell them a list of questions, either over email in advance or at the beginning of your call, what you do is that you kind of cut off the fresh original responses that they might say. But what you can do is you can tell them the topics. You can tell them the flow. So for instance, you could tell them, you know, if I'm going to make up an interview here. Okay, I was just in Iceland yesterday driving around for like 12,000 hours. And I was in this island area, which seems to have far fewer tourists than the rest of the island, but it was stunning. And I think it was one of the most beautiful parts, and all the blog posts said that. So say I was interviewing the mayor of the main city there, and his office asked me what the interview was about or to send some questions. I might say, you know, okay, I'd like to ask him, you know, what proportion of tourists who visit Iceland he feels comes here, what type of responses he gets from those tourists, and what recommendations he has for tourists who are coming to the islands to get the best out of their experience. So I'm just kind of giving in sentence form the general gist direction that I'm going to talk about, but I'm not saying verbatim the questions. Because the thing is that as you formulate these questions, and I'm going to see if I can go back to my interview with Tanya for you to see, as you're doing these questions, they're often going to have a little preamble, okay? There's often going to be a sentence before your question that either connects it to the previous question or pivots, especially for ramblers, pivots away from what they're talking about to what you want to talk about, or that establishes, like I was talking about the super bloom and the botanist, that establishes that you have some background on the topic at hand that you are bringing into the conversation. So this is why we don't give them questions verbatim, because then they've prepared for the exact words of the question and they get put off or like confused when we ask the question a different way. But it's definitely helpful to give the shape and the kind of overall outline of your questions in advance. So tell them what you're going to talk about is very useful, I think, but don't tell them the specific questions. Now, on the record or recording, never, ever, 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 ever mention the term on the record, okay? This is like this weird cultural thing that people who aren't journalists have appropriated, how it's used, and people in the general populace kind of have a misunderstanding of it. So it's best to not start your calls by saying, just so you know, this is on the record, because it spooks people. Like, they don't really know what it means, and they get scared about where and how their words are going to be used and all these things. Is it on the record? It is on the record, yes. But if you say that, you essentially make them skittish. If people have issues with what they've said and they want to review the quotes later, that's a different story. And you should always check with your editor first, but many editors, particularly in the travel space, agree that it's perfectly fine to show them only the quotations and have them approve them before they go to print, basically, so they don't get sued. However, on the record is different than recording. If you are recording, then you must tell them. You cannot record any interview, any person speaking, any conversation legally in the U.S. without letting the other party know. So this also means if you are recording, you know, a conference talk, this is something that really gets on my nerves. When people are recording on their own little recording devices conference talks, you really shouldn't be doing that unless you've told the presenter that you're doing that. It's just like a really base question of legality, even more so than this notion of being on the record. So anytime on the phone or in person that you're recording an interview that you're doing, you should always let the person know. And you should also know, as I mentioned, that when you say the word record, whether it's record or recording, that it might spook people. So this is part of why I don't record most of my calls and I just live transcribe them, because I don't want people to get into that, oh my God, I'm being recorded mindset. Now, setting ground rules. This is another one that if you have found from the get-go that you have a rambler, like that you pick up the phone and you're trying to be business and they're all chit-chat and they start racing off with their talking points that they prepared for you, it can be really great to say, wow, thanks so much for telling me all that. I'd love to get going with the questions I prepared for you. Not that you're really preparing a lot of questions, but just to make them think now we're starting. I'd love to get going with my questions that I prepared for you. But in the meantime, let's just set, you know, a couple parameters for a conversation. So I just want to let you know, I don't want to keep you any longer than the 15 minutes that I told you this call was going to go, and I myself also have other appointments. So I want to make sure that we wrap up by blah, 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 blah time. So in that time, I really want to make sure that we cover the details around your new hotel opening and the cuisine that's going to be featured at the restaurant. And also, I want to hear more about the background of the chef as well. So let's get going with those topics, and I'll keep an eye on time as we go along. So that's a way to set ground rules. And what that does, it goes back to what I was saying on the previous slide, which is gaining trust in you as the person who's controlling this conversation. And the thing is, if you have a source who is a little skittish or they've never done an interview before, both setting the ground rules and also telling them what you're going to talk about can really help them to feel that trust in you as an interviewer, and that you are kind of present them in the best light. So I just want to answer this one question quickly. How do you judge how much time you'll need for interviews? When I started doing interviews, oh my God, I would allot so much time, and I would keep people on the phone forever, and I would like beat the dead horse, and I would just ask them so many questions until I kind of knew everything or thought I knew everything, and then I would go try to write it up, and I would have so much material and I wouldn't know what to do with it. So now my rule of thumb is that I, on the phone, this is different than in person, and I kind of hate doing in-person interviews because it's much harder to control the time, to be honest. But on the phone, I try to always keep it to 15, 20 minutes, if not less. I've gotten great interviews, like everything I need for the story that I'm doing in 7 minutes. Like, I can do that if you're on the same page, right? If you're both to the point, it's the holiday weekend, they're trying to get out of the office, they called you so you can get your story done. But I try to allot 15 to 20 minutes for each interview. If I am doing a feature story that's entirely interview-based, like the one that we're going to talk about when we do the live putting the interview into article form, then I typically allot more like 20 to 25 minutes. But I find that people tend to, if they're a source in a story, it's different if you're doing a whole profile about them. That's a very different scene. But that people tend to fall off attention-wise in the 20 to 25 minute zone. And that's because, like, how often do you find yourself just having a conversation with a total stranger who's not somebody that's going to be your bosom buddy for life, for longer than that, right? Like when you're at a cocktail party or whatever, that's kind of the threshold. So I think I try to keep it in that range. And if you're doing a profile, I actually recommend talking to the source multiple times rather than just talking to them for a longer time. Okay, so I want to get going in the next couple slides. Somebody just had one other question I want to get to quickly. What about on the flip side, when you get an interviewee that is just a terrible talker and you've used all your tricks for getting the open up and share? Are there tips for getting good quotes out of them? Thanks, Alicia. That's a great question. So I mentioned earlier about having bad sources who just don't want to talk. I think I've really had like 3 out of the 500 plus, way more than 500 actually, out of the hundreds and hundreds of interviews that I've done. So I really think I've only had like 2 or 3 cases where I could not for the life of me get them to say anything. And in those cases, what I have done is, like, I'll ask them a question and then they give me a one-word answer. Basically, this is the kind of bad people we're talking about. So in that case, what I start to do is I ask them such insanely open questions that they have to at least give me a couple words. Like, what's your favorite blah? Or when was a moment when blah? So, like, they have to at least start giving me more than one word. And then I can say, oh, yeah, tell me about that. Oh, yeah, tell me about that. That's a great one. Or tell me more about that. Or, you know, take those couple of words and just treat them like a child, not in your tone of voice, but in the way you're asking them questions, and say, oh, was it this? Was it that? And eventually you can piece together enough one-word answers that you kind of can do something. Okay, all right, let's get going because I have a couple things that I want to make sure to get to. So all too often, journalists start an interview armed only with a handful of questions. This is actually a typo from them, not me. A handful of questions scribbled in their notebooks. So I've touched on, but not completely talked about, the issue with writing your questions in advance. So let's see what the next slide says. So the issue, like I said, with writing your questions in advance, on the one hand is the source, right? You don't want to spoil the source. but you also don't want to spoil the trail of your interview. So this is really important because your interview, like I said, should be about discovery. You could be discovering what the point of your story actually is. You could be discovering interesting background that leads you to take the story in a different direction. You could be discovering that this business is so much more interesting than you thought it was, that they have all these new programs coming online, and they're working with this nonprofit, and they just got their certification for this, and so on and so forth. So you never, ever know where the interview is going to go, and that's actually the point, right? Like, an interview, like I said, a question and listening to the answer, it's not that you know where it is going. You know what you need to get out of it or what you would like to get out of it. So the best way to avoid having questions and then ending up with nothing because the answers to your questions weren't actually what you needed to write the story. You needed other information that wasn't in your questions is to prepare for your interviews by preparing background rather than questions. So background might mean, to go back to this made-up example about the botanist and the superbloom, background might mean reading some papers, you know, if you're talking to an academic, that the source has written about the subject. It might mean if somebody, for instance, I worked for Meeting Planning magazines for several years, it might mean looking up that person's company and what events have been done. It might mean, though, something much more general, not about the source. And I tend to think that you're much better off preparing about the topic generally, so that you can speak in the same terms as them, so that you can speak on their wavelength, so that you have an understanding of the industry enough that when you say, uh-huh, you actually mean, yes, I get that, and you can get into deeper points with them. But the beauty of preparing generally also is that it allows you to very truly and honestly ask about specifics in what is one of my favorite questions. So I heard about this approach from somebody who's kind of a nutrition, health, fitness writer, I believe. She interviews a lot of people with letters, so like PhDs, RNs, MDs, people like that, for her stories. And she likes to tell them, even if she knows about a topic, she likes to ask them to explain it to her like they would explain it to a layman. That's the way she says it. And that's how she gets the quotes, you know, about how this new supplement really works, all these things. That's how she gets the quotes that she can use in her articles for Self or Marie Claire or something like that, rather than the sciencese, which is the same sort of thing that one of these doctors would say to their colleagues. So in travel, we have not quite the same, you know, set of issues. So my favorite first question, which you can apply to any situation, is how does topic, whatever the topic of the article is, in destination business, whatever is the affiliation of the person you're talking to, or sorry, not how does, what is the most important thing about topic in business or destination that is relevant to my readers? Or that my readers need to know. And so this is really important because, as you see, I've really grounded it in useful information. But rather than doing my own resource or just putting in the question, what is this the most important thing? Or like, this is the most important thing, right? Or how come this is the most important thing? I simply ask the source what they think is the most important thing. And this is brilliant. Because you might find out things about the destination or the business or the whatever that you totally didn't know, that you couldn't know, or that you just didn't find that are really important for your story. So, for instance, a good example of this is I was talking about how I used to write a lot for meeting planning magazines. And so I would talk to a lot of destinations, and I would say to them, you know, why is Roseville, Illinois, such a great destination for meetings? And I don't know that anybody ever told me stuff that I already knew. I think there were always new things that I didn't know about. And then the rest of the conversation became, oh, yeah, can you tell me more about this thing you mentioned? And then they tell me about that, and I either go back to something that they mentioned in the most important things for the subjects to know, or I say, oh, can you tell me more about that distillery that's making grass to glass completely out of northern Midwest products? How does that work? You know, so by asking that one question at the beginning, it's not even so much that it just keeps you from having to prepare, right? Because as I said, background is much more important than questions. And I'm going to type the question here. So the wording of the question was, what is the most important thing about topic? And again, like I was saying when I did the Meeting Magazine example, it's slightly different. But it's essentially most is the most important thing about topic in their business or destination for my readers. And I'm going to send to all, so hopefully you all get that. So, like I said, to switch that for the context I was talking about, I would say, why is Roseville, Illinois such a great destination for meeting planners? So the exact wording changes over time. But the essence of the question is to ask your source to tell you what's the point. To ask your source to tell you what they think your story should be about. Now, is that what your story is going to be about? Not necessarily, but it's really important to have their viewpoint and to have it in their own words. That makes really great quotes. But secondarily, not just only do you have their viewpoint, but you have their reasons. So they're going to build a case for you as to why their viewpoint is true. And then you get all these facts. You get all these things that exist, you know, the number of hotels, the flights, different destinations, whatever it is. You get facts that they're using to build their case that you can use either to build that same point that they've made or to build your own point, and you start asking them about those facts. But I want to focus on for a second this idea again that it's not about the questions, it's about the interaction. So how do we make sure with our questions that we're not writing in advance but that we just kind of ask them as we go along, how do we make sure that we're having a good interaction? We've talked about how to handle ramblers. We've talked about how to handle people who don't really want to talk very much. I want to share this with you. So when former New York Times reporter Mirta Oito interviews experts, she said, "I try to know almost as much as they do about their subject, so it seems we are chatting." Now, is it possible for her to actually know as much? No. But it's actually not so hard to hop on Wikipedia, to hop on, you know, depending on how technical you are, to read some white papers, whatever the subject is, and really get up to speed in a way where it sounds, because of how different you sound to the average person, it sounds to your source like you really know a lot. There's a big business writer who says, if you read 3 books about a topic, you know more than 99% of the population about that topic, or some numbers close to that. And it's really true. It doesn't take that long to become highly, highly knowledgeable about something. So even if you just spend 20, 30 minutes reading about it, you're going to know really a lot. I typically spend, and this is usually more in the pitch phase, but I would typically spend 15 to 20 minutes really diving into something that I'm going to do an interview about in terms of background research. I read quickly, though, so that might not be the same for all of you. In terms of questions, so I gave you my favorite first question. I'm going to give you my favorite last question. How many questions should you prepare? So like I said, you shouldn't necessarily have questions. You should have topics, right, like kind of talking points or something. And when I told you this made-up idea of interviewing the mayor of the Westman Islands in Iceland, I listed 3 things that I might want to ask him, right? That's really the most that you should have in terms of objective things. Because when you put that together, when you sandwich it with the first question, and then this closing question I'm going to give you, these 3 other things that you want to know about make 5. And that's really enough, if not too many. So here's another tidbit from the Pointner Journalism website for you. Try to ask a maximum of 3 or 4 questions. An interview is not a fishing expedition. So this goes back to that question about how long should they take. And I said when I first started doing them, I did them forever. I just beat the horse to death in my interview. I was doing a fishing expedition. And part of it was perhaps not having research, but more so it was because I was trying to figure out every last piece of information so I didn't miss anything. So it continues. If you can't get to the essence of what you want the interviewee to say in 3 or 4 questions, change the questions, okay? So I told you not to write questions, but in terms of writing your topics or your talking points or your turning points or what you want to cover, you should, in just that few, be able to get what you need to from this person, from your topic. If not, revisit their background or your topic and find fewer. And the way to do that is by making them more general, right? We're not asking them yes or no questions. We're asking them open-ended questions. But this leads to this problem, that open-ended questions create open answers, which can go on forever, and sometimes not talking about anything about your point. So it is on you. If they are going on, it is on you because you have made the commitment to the time, you have made the commitment to the topic, and because you have other work to do, and because they also have other work to do, and they've just forgotten because they're very happy to talk to somebody about something they're passionate about, or because they just like to talk. So it is 100% on you to move things along, and that's why it's very useful, if not to set actual ground rules, but to tell people what you're going to talk about in advance, because then you can say, thanks so much for telling me about blah, 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 but I'm not sure that that's really going to fit into the piece, so I wanted to take you back to what we were talking about previously, and then you ask another question. What if they just don't let you get in? So I'm going to hopefully, when I do these interviews live in a couple weeks, I'm going to hopefully tell somebody to do that so that I can show you, but they might all be too nice to do it. But if somebody just doesn't let you in, yes, you do have to interrupt them. They have to breathe sometime, really. Like, most people can't talk, not just swim, but talk for more than 30 seconds or so without taking a breath. And even if they don't take a breath and they just keep talking, they keep talking, and there's something in there, right? Like, I took a little bit of breath there. So there's something that you can find, and eventually their sentence will have a period. And what you can also do, right, there's a difference between interrupting and talking over. You also sometimes need to just talk over them. And this is best done if they flip, like if they start talking about a new topic, but there wasn't enough of a break for you to really get in. And that's when you say, oh, like, don't start saying words, but like just like say something, and then as soon as they stop talking, then say words. But if you just say words over them, especially on the phone, it's not going to get through. So let them say something and then say, oh, that reminds me. Okay? Totally not a rude way. I mean, it's kind of rude because you're interrupting, but to somebody who talks like that, it's not so rude. Make it positive. Spin it that way. And then make your questions less open-ended. As soon as you've identified that they're a talker, you need to make your questions much, 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 much less open-ended, unfortunately, because they're going to be expansive no matter what you ask. Now, in terms of bringing it home, right, I've essentially told you there's no roadmap, just ask them to expand, you know, circle back to something else that you liked. How do you know where you're going? How do you make sure that you get stuff? So this goes back to what I was saying about not necessarily having questions, but having topics. So I want to share this with you. So this is from a guy who interviews professional interviewers. So he does a podcast called Long Form. So he said long interviews can have three acts. Know where you want to start, where you want to end, and how you want to get there. And let the subject know the plan, right? So we talked about that earlier. These conversations can go off the rails quick. Laying out the roadmap early lets you easily interrupt and move things along. It makes it feel like you're on the same team. And so this is another reason why I really like in the beginning to say, you know, what's the most important thing for my readers to know? Or I don't just say my readers, I say for, you know, for meeting planners or for, you know, leisure travelers coming to Iceland independently or something like that. So by sticking in who the audience is early on, it also really helps you to pivot away from things that aren't a fit for that audience because you've warned them, you've told them, like, everything we talk about right now needs to relate back to this type of person. Now, my favorite way to end it, and something that I recommend all of you do, and unfortunately I've been doing this for so long, I don't know where I got this piece of advice, is to wrap up by saying, it's kind of a reflective of that first question that we did. Is there anything else I didn't already ask you about this topic that my readers should know about? Is there anything else about this topic that I didn't already asked you, this is important because sometimes they just want to like tell you more about something that you already talked about, and that's not what we want here. So is there anything else about this topic that I didn't already ask you that my readers should know about? So this is important because it gets them to say something they may have already said in a different way, or it brings up something that you really want to know that didn't come up earlier. One of these two things. And either of the results, no matter which direction it goes, are incredibly valuable. Like, this is often going to be the part where suddenly, out of the blue, the source just goes off on this monologue about the importance of whatever it is that you're talking about that you wish that they had been talking about all along. Resist the urge, though, to ask too many follow-ups on that last thing, because you've kind of made a nice closure. And even if they've said something really lovely, it's said as a climax, right? So if you try to follow up, the energy is kind of changed. So if you have more follow-ups after that last thing that they've said, I recommend that you do that over email. And at the end, after you've said that question and you thank them for your time, you should always say, I'll follow up with you over email if I have any further questions. Because there's this weird, like, you've created this trust, you have this great bond, there's this moment, and then it's over. So you want to close it nicely by telling them that, no, that the connection can continue. That's what I've got for today.